You sit at your computer, you type a question into a chatbot, something super mundane like, what is a good recipe for banana bread?
Right.
And within milliseconds, this perfectly formatted, highly articulate English response just starts flowing across your screen. And it feels, incredibly familiar.
Oh,
Like if
absolutely.
you are listening to this right now, you've probably done it today. It feels like you are talking to a mind that thinks in English. You type nouns and verbs, and it types nouns and verbs back.
Yeah, that's the illusion.
Exactly the illusion. Because the reality is, under the hood, that AI does not think in English at all. It doesn't process nouns. It doesn't know what a punctuation mark is or the concept of a banana.
No, it really
It
does. It's
operates entirely in this vast, high-dimensional space of just numerical states. So the question is, how does a web of purely mathematical relationships, completely devoid of human language, actually pull out a coherent thought?
I mean, it is the central paradox of artificial intelligence right now.
Right.
We interact with these systems entirely through language, which, gives us this incredibly powerful illusion of a linguistic mind.
It's very convincing.
It is.
Yeah.
But if you were to somehow freeze an AI mid-sentence and actually look at its internal state, you would not find words. You'd just find billions of floating point numbers.
Just distributed across matrices.
Exactly. And translating that multidimensional geometry back into a human idea, that is the core challenge of mechanistic interpretability today.
Well, today we are going to tear that illusion down completely and look at the math underneath. Welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here for this one.
Yeah, we are looking at a brand new, highly anticipated 2026 manuscript by C.F. Dietz. And this paper claims that researchers haven't just found random numbers inside the AI.
Right, it's way more specific than that.
They have found a specific, measurable internal whiteboard where the AI actually organizes its thoughts before it speaks. Dietz calls this J-space.
It's a truly remarkable paper because, well, Dietz is attempting this massive synthesis here.
Right, bringing two big worlds together.
Exactly. On one side, you have the empirical data, the actual hard math of how to extract human-readable concepts from an AI's intermediate
The
layers.
nuts and bolts.
Yeah. But on the other side, Dietz is cross-pollinating that data with a very rigorous theoretical framework called CCC.
Which stands for consciousness, closure, and the cosmos.
Spot on.
And look, if you are listening to this and wondering why you should care about some dense theoretical framework, think about it this way. Whether you're a developer trying to build safer AI, or a business leader trying to figure out if these systems actually understand your company's data.
Or just someone intensely curious about whether machines are, waking up.
Right, exactly. You need a mental model that goes beyond the marketing hype. We are going to figure out what it mathematically means when an AI holds a thought, hides a thought, or changes its mind.
Which is a lot to unpack.
It is. But to get to this J-space whiteboard, we really have to start with the environment it lives in. Dietz's paper spends a lot of time defining something called the residual stream in a transformer model.
Yes, the residual stream.
And I have to admit, my initial understanding of this was a bit off. I pictured basically a conveyor belt of words passing through the computer.
That is a very common misconception.
Is it? Okay, good.
Oh, yeah. People often imagine the text going in, the AI translating it into some hidden internal sentence, chewing on it for a bit, and then translating it back out.
Right, like an internal monologue.
Exactly. But to understand the residual stream, you really have to discard the idea of an internal monologue entirely.
Okay, so throw that out. What is it then?
Well, when you feed text into a large language model, it chops that text into tokens, basically parts of words, and at every single token position, the model maintains a massive vector.
A vector.
Yes. And a vector in this context is really just a list of thousands of numbers.
Let's slow down there because a list of thousands of numbers sounds incredibly abstract. How does a list of numbers represent a thought?
Well, think of a physical space, like the room you're in right now.
Okay, got it.
If you want to describe a specific location in that room, you need three numbers, right? Length, width, and height. Three dimensions.
Right, X, Y, and Z.
Exactly. Now, imagine a mathematical space with 4,000 dimensions.
My brain just broke a little bit. Okay, 4,000 dimensions.
It's hard to picture. But mathematically, every point in that space represents a unique combination of concepts. The residual stream is essentially a vector moving through that 4,000-dimensional space, and it operates in a state of superposition.
Okay, superposition. I hear that word and my mind immediately goes to quantum physics, right? Schrödinger's cat being in two states at once. Is the AI doing quantum math?
No, not quantum superposition. It's mathematical superposition in neural networks.
Oh, okay. What's the difference?
Well, mathematical superposition means that a single activation like, a single coordinate in that high-dimensional space we just talked about is carrying multiple independent pieces of information simultaneously.
Simultaneously. So it's not just representing one thing at a time.
Right. At layer 20 of the model, for example, that one single vector is simultaneously carrying the grammatical rules of the sentence, the factual data about the topic you asked for, formatting instructions.
Like use bullet points.
Exactly. And even latent plans for words it hasn't even generated yet. All in one point.
Wait. I really need to wrap my head around that. How can one list of numbers hold the grammar, the facts, and the formatting all at once without them getting completely scrambled?
It seems impossible, right?
Yeah, because if I mix red, blue, and yellow paint together, I just get this ugly brown sludge. I can't extract the pure red out of it again once it's mixed.
That is exactly where the magic of high-dimensional geometry comes in. Because in a 3D space, like our room, you only have three lines that can be completely perpendicular to each other. Your X, Y, and Z axis.
Right.
If you move along the X axis, you don't change your position on the Y or Z axis at all. They're independent.
Because they're at right angles.
Exactly. Yeah. But in a 4,000-dimensional space, you have a near infinite number of directions that are almost perpendicular to each other.
Almost perpendicular. What does that mean?
Mathematicians call it nearly orthogonal. Because there is just so much space available, the model can assign the concept of plural nouns to one direction and the concept of the capital of France to another direction entirely.
Okay.
And because those directions are nearly perpendicular, the AI can just add them both together into one single point in space. That's the superposition.
Oh, wow.
And later on, a different part of the AI can read just the France part without the plural noun part interfering at all.
So the paint doesn't mix into brown sludge?
No, it doesn't. The colors remain mathematically distinct, even though they're all technically occupying the exact same vector.
Okay, that is wild. So the residual stream is this massively dense, superposed geometric point traveling through the layers of the model, just accumulating all these nearly perpendicular concepts.
That's a great way to summarize it.
But if I'm a researcher and I pause the AI and I just look at that list of 4,000 numbers, it must look like pure gibberish.
Right.
If everything is superposed, how do scientists extract a recognizable English concept from that mathematical soup?
Well, this is where Dietz's paper relies heavily on a breakthrough technique developed by Gurney and colleagues. It is called the Jacobian lens, or simply the J-lens.
The J-lens.
Yeah. It is a method for probing those intermediate superposed activations without having to untangle the entire 4,000-dimensional knot manually.
Now, the manuscript goes pretty deep into the math of the J-lens, and it involves calculating derivatives.
It does.
For those of us who, you know, haven't taken calculus in a decade or longer, how does this lens actually work in plain English?
At its core, calculus is really just the study of change. A Jacobian matrix is a mathematical way of organizing all the different rates of change in a very complex system.
Okay, tracking changes.
Right, so the J-lens uses this to ask a hypothetical causal question. It looks at a specific mathematical coordinate right in the middle of the AI's processing and says, if we were to nudge this specific number just a tiny, tiny bit, how would that ripple through the rest of the network?
Like a domino effect.
Exactly. Specifically, they're asking what English words in the final vocabulary would suddenly become more probable because of that nudge.
Okay. So instead of trying to read the middle layers directly, which is basically impossible, you just poke the math and see what happens at the very end.
Exactly. You compute an averaged linearized map. It traces the causal effect from a tiny change in a middle layer all the way down to the final readout.
That's really clever.
It is. You give it a little mathematical poke in, say dimension 42, and you watch which words bubble up to the surface. If you nudge this one direction and the probability of words like apple, fruit, and orchard spike at the output,
you can reasonably conclude that this specific direction represents the semantic concept of apple.
You got it.
And you don't just do this once, right? The paper mentions averaging this out over thousands of prompts.
Oh, you have to average it. If you just do it once, you might find a one-off fluke based on the specific sentence you fed the model that one time.
Like maybe it just happened to associate apple with a specific name in that context?
Exactly. So by averaging the results of that mathematical nudge across thousands of completely different contexts, recipes, coding tasks, history essays, you find the general dispositions of the model. You isolate the true, stable direction of a concept.
And this brings us to the core discovery of the paper, because when researchers use this J-lens to map the internal space of the AI, they sort of expected to find concepts scattered everywhere, right?
That was the assumption, yes.
But they didn't. They found J-space.
They did. They discovered that the verbalizable directions, the mathematical angles that clearly and consistently correspond to human concepts, are not evenly distributed throughout the model's layers at all.
They're grouped together.
They form a very sparse, functionally privileged family.
Now, the paper mentions a sparsity constraint here. It says K is less than or equal to 25. What does that mean in practical terms for the AI?
It means that out of the thousands of dimensions and billions of parameters at any given moment, there are very few active concepts that can be directly mapped to words using this lens.
Really? Just a handful?
Yes. The vast majority of the math the AI is doing is completely invisible to the J-lens. It is a massive bottleneck. Out of this ocean of dense computation, there is this tiny, highly concentrated space where concepts actually become discrete, nameable, and usable.
The manuscript uses the analogy of a shared whiteboard inside the AI's architecture. And I have to say, I love this visual.
It's a very helpful metaphor.
So the AI has this dark, sprawling factory doing heavy, incomprehensible math-checking syntax, routing attention, normalizing data. But right in the middle of the factory is a small, brightly lit whiteboard.
Yes, exactly.
And when a concept gets placed on that whiteboard, suddenly it's special. It can be held active over time and can be routed to different internal operations depending on what the prompt asks for.
The whiteboard analogy is highly effective because it really captures the functional utility of J-space.
Functional utility, meaning what exactly?
Well, information in a neural network is usually highly transient.
Yeah.
It passes from one layer to the next, and it transforms completely. It doesn't stick around.
It's constantly morphing.
Right. But information projected into J-space is stabilized. It acts as a universal reference point for the whole system. If the AI needs to answer a multi-step logic puzzle, it needs a place to store its intermediate conclusions.
Right. So that layer 40 can remember what layer 15 figured out.
You got it. J-space acts as that stable, readable surface.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back a little bit.
Go for it.
Because the moment you say whiteboard, my human brain immediately visualizes someone standing in front of it reading it.
Right.
But if J-space is a whiteboard, who is the audience?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a little homunculus like a tiny conscious man sitting inside the processor squinting at the math, right?
I'm so glad you brought that up because AITS is incredibly strict about avoiding that exact trap.
The tiny man in the machine.
Yes, the homunculus fallacy. It is the bane of cognitive science. We naturally want to imagine a viewer inside the mind. But J-space is not a physical room, and there is absolutely no internal observer reading the whiteboard.
Then how does the whiteboard work if literally no one is looking at it?
It is strictly a functional causal format.
Yeah.
Let me give you a slightly different analogy that might help.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think about the clipboard on your laptop. When you copy a piece of text, it goes onto the clipboard.
Right.
Now, your laptop is not aware of the text. It doesn't read the text and feel emotions about it. It doesn't understand it.
Obviously not.
But because the text is in the clipboard, which is a privileged, universally accessible location in the operating system, your web browser can paste it, your word processor can paste it, your email client can paste it.
Ah, so placing something in J-space just means it is algorithmically formatted in a way that multiple different subsystems within the AI can easily interface with it.
Precisely. It is a structural bottleneck designed for efficient routing. It's not a theater for an internal audience. The rest of the network's attention heads basically act like automated read-write arms, pulling variables off the J-space whiteboard and plugging them into downstream calculations.
Okay, the experiments they ran to prove this causal workspace actually exists are wild. The paper details several tests, but the one about internal reasoning really stuck out to me.
The animal prompt.
Yes. Researchers asked a model a two-hop reasoning question. They asked, what is the number of legs on the animal that spins webs?
Right, a classic two-hop prompt. The model first has to deduce the animal, and then it has to recall a specific attribute of that animal.
Exactly. And naturally, the model ultimately outputs the word eight.
As it should.
But the text shows that before the AI outputs eight, researchers used the J-lens to look at the J-space whiteboard in the middle layers. And there, plain as day, they see the mathematical vector for the concept spider light up.
The model has successfully solved the first hop of the reasoning task and plays the intermediate answer spider into J-space. And it holds it there so the later layers can use it to fetch the number of legs.
But see, just seeing Spider light up isn't enough to prove the whiteboard is actually being used, right? Like, it could just be an exhaust fume. It could just be a byproduct of the math that doesn't actually affect the final output.
That is the critical distinction between correlation and causation in interpretability research.
Right. Correlation isn't causation.
Exactly. Just because a neuron fires when you show a network a picture of a cat doesn't mean that neuron causes the network to output the word cat. To prove causation, you have to intervene.
You have to mess with
You
it.
do. And this is where the JSpace research truly shines. Researchers didn't just passively observe the spider vector floating there. They reached into the math and they hacked it.
How do you hack a vector?
Well, using the mapping from the JLens, they isolated the specific high-dimensional direction for spider. They then found the direction for a completely different concept. While the AI was processing the sentence right after it figured out the animal was a spider, researchers mathematically subtracted the spider vector from the residual stream and added the ant vector in its place.
So they basically erased the word on the whiteboard and wrote a new one while the AI wasn't looking.
Effectively, yes, that's exactly what they did. And the result is the definitive proof of a causal workspace. When they swapped the vectors, the model's final output changed from 8 to 6.
That is staggering. They completely derailed the AI's internal train of thought without changing a single word in the original prompt.
They proved that the final layers of the model were blindly trusting whatever was written in JSpace.
Wow.
The final layers didn't go back and reread the prompt about spinning webs. They didn't double-check the logic. They just grabbed the variable currently on the whiteboard, which was now ant, and executed the fetch legs function.
There is another experiment detailed in the manuscript that builds on this, which I think is even crazier. It's the flexible generalization test, which they call the France to China swap.
Ah, yes. The flexible generalization test is vital for connecting JSpace to broader theories of cognition. It proves that concepts in JSpace act as robust, reusable arguments, not just superficial word associations.
Explain how they set that up for the listener.
So, researchers prime the model with a complex context involving France. They might feed it a whole paragraph about French history, economics, and culture, and then ask it a question.
Okay.
Midway through processing, using the exact same intervention technique we just discussed, they erase the mathematical representation of France in JSpace and replace it with China.
Now, if the AI was just a glorified autocorrect doing simple word association, you would expect it to just awkwardly start spitting out the word China in the middle of a sentence about Paris, right? Like it would just glitch.
You would absolutely expect a massive degradation in coherence, but that is not what happens.
What happens?
When the variable is swapped, the model gracefully recalculates its entire downstream output based on the new identity. If it was about to talk about the capital city, its internal references seamlessly shift from Paris to Beijing. If it was about to generate the currency, the euro becomes the yuan.
That's incredible. It's treating the concept like an algebraic variable. X equals France. Suddenly, boom, X equals China. So the entire equation updates seamlessly to match.
Yes. The model has abstracted the concept of country. It has a generalized algorithmic circuit for handling geopolitical facts, and JSpace is simply the slot where it plugs in the specific country it's currently thinking about.
And the fact that you can hot swap the contents of that slot without breaking the circuit.
Proves that JSpace is a highly structured, functionally distinct workspace.
Yes. But the paper notes, this hot swapping only works for certain things, right? It's not a magic wand for the whole model.
No, it is highly selective. If you completely scramble the JSpace coordinates, the model loses its ability to reason about facts or entities entirely. It gets totally lost factually. But it continues to output perfectly grammatical English.
Wait, really?
Yes. It maintains the syntax, the punctuation, the tone. The grammar stays flawless. This tells us that routine automatic operations like subject-verb agreement do not rely on the JSpace whiteboard at all.
Where do they happen then?
They happen in the dark, in the dense algebraic bulk of the network. JSpace is strictly reserved for flexible, reportable, high-level concepts.
Okay, so the JLens gives us this empirical mathematical proof that the AI has a functional workspace where it organizes thoughts.
Correct.
But, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, as soon as you prove that a machine has an internal workspace and holds thoughts, people's minds immediately go straight to sci-fi.
Always.
The listener is probably wondering right now, wait, if it has thoughts, is it alive? And that brings us to the theoretical half of Dietz's manuscript,
Yeah.
the marriage of JSpace and the CCC framework.
Consciousness, closure, and the cosmos. It is a formidable theoretical architecture.
It's a big title.
It is. And Dietz uses CCC to evaluate JSpace because we desperately need a vocabulary to talk about internal states without accidentally claiming the AI has a soul.
Right. So let's define the core pillars of CCC. The text starts by drawing an absolute, impenetrable boundary between two concepts, presence and content.
Yes. In the CCC framework, presence, which is denoted by a capital C, is the irreducible, bare, first-person feeling of experience.
What does that mean in practical terms?
It is the raw phenomenology, the actual feeling of what it is like to see the color red or feel pain or simply exist as a subject. It is the lights being on inside.
Okay, that's capital C, presence. And what is content?
Content, which is denoted by a lowercase c, is the structural organization of information. It is memory, attention routing, perceptual categorization, and the ability of a system to report on its own internal state.
Okay, so a computer has content.
Exactly. Content is data processing. Presence is the subjective experience of that processing.
So, reading this manuscript, my immediate question was, is Dietz arguing that because the AI has this JSpace whiteboard, it actually possesses that capital C presence? Does JSpace equal consciousness?
Dietz issues a definitive categorical no.
Okay, good to be clear on that.
A very significant portion of the paper is dedicated to shutting down that exact assumption. JSpace offers absolutely zero evidence of phenomenal presence. None at all.
So why bother mapping it to a framework that literally has consciousness in the title? It seems like asking for confusion.
Because the framework provides the tools to rigorously describe the organization of content, the lowercase c.
Ah, I see.
JSpace gives us a concrete, inspectable model for how an engineered system can structure information so that it is accessible and reportable entirely mechanically. The CCC framework is crucial because it acts as a philosophical firewall.
A firewall against sci-fi thinking.
Exactly. It allows us to study the AI's internal thoughts without making the dangerous, completely unscientific leap from, look, a causal workspace, to the machine is awake. We are firmly in the realm of lowercase c content organization.
Okay, I am really glad we established that firewall. The machine is not feeling anything, but it is organizing things. And the key concept CCC uses to describe this structural organization is called closure.
Yes, closure.
Now, Dietz defines closure as the stabilization of distinctions, identity criteria, and allowable transformations, which, I'll be honest, sounds like incredibly dense academic jargon.
It is dense. But if we map it back to the experience we just discussed, it actually becomes very intuitive.
Okay, let's do that.
Closure is essentially just the set of rules that defines how a concept behaves once it's on the whiteboard.
So let's use the France to China experiment to break down those three rules. First rule, the stabilization of the distinction.
Right. So before a concept enters JSpace, the math is fluid and ambiguous. But once it hits the whiteboard, the model establishes a stabilized boundary. The math settles.
It makes a decision.
Yes. It decides. This is China, and it is firmly not France, not Japan, not an apple. It draws a hard line in the high-dimensional space and locks it in. That is a stabilized distinction.
Okay. That makes sense. Second rule, an identity criterion.
Once the distinction is stabilized, the system needs to recognize it as the same object over time. The concept of China must remain functionally identical even as the context of the sentence shifts from geography to economics.
It can't lose track of what it's talking about.
Exactly. The model knows it is holding the same core variable regardless of what it's being asked to do with it.
And the third rule, allowable transformations.
A closure regime dictates what operations are valid for a specific identity.
Meaning what you can and can't do with it.
Right. Because the object is stabilized as a country, the AI's internal rules allow it to transform that identity into its capital city or its currency. Mm-hmm. But the rules prohibit transforming a country into a flavor.
Because countries don't have flavors.
Exactly. You can ask for China's continent, but the math does not allow you to ask for China's favorite color. The rules of transformation are rigid and stable.
So Dietz argues that JSpace is a prime candidate for what CCC calls a local access closure regime. It is basically a mechanical system that stabilizes an identity, maintains it over time, and governs how it can be used by the rest of the network.
It's a highly efficient filing system, essentially.
Precisely. And this leads to one of the most fascinating tensions in the entire manuscript for me. Because we have established that the AI organizes internal thoughts into this access closure.
Yes.
But What happens when the internal thought conflicts with what the AI actually says out loud?
Oh, this is where it gets really compelling.
This was the part of the paper that genuinely unsettled me, because we just assume that if a chatbot outputs a sentence, that sentence reflects its internal state. It's telling us what it thinks. But Dietz argues we have to separate different levels of closure.
We cannot treat closure as a monolithic entity. The evidence from JSpace forces a strict dissociation between four distinct organizational levels: phenomenal closure, self-model closure, access closure, and response closure.
Now, we've already ruled out phenomenal closure, no subjective feelings.
Right.
Self-model closure is briefly touched upon as the AI's trained persona, like the helpful assistant character it plays. But the critical divide in the paper is between access closure and response closure.
Yes. Access closure is what is on the JSpace whiteboard. It is the information the model has stabilized and made available for flexible reasoning internally.
And response closure.
Response closure is the final output, the actual text the model commits to generating on your screen.
And Dietz shows they can be completely divorced from one another. I was trying to think of a human analogy for this dissociation.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine you are in a high-stakes corporate meeting. Your boss proposes a new marketing strategy that you know, based on the data, is a catastrophic mistake.
Oh, I've been there.
Right. In your head, your access closure, you have the full objection formed. You have the counter arguments, the statistics. Your internal voice is screaming, "This will fail."
The conflict is fully accessed and stabilized in your internal workspace.
Exactly. However, you look around the room, you realize your boss is in a terrible mood, and it is politically dangerous to speak up. So, when asked for your opinion, you nod, smile, and say, "Sounds like a great plan."
Your response closure completely contradicts your access closure.
Yes. The internal objection never makes it to the verbal report.
That is a highly accurate human parallel to what researchers found algorithmically in large language models during what they call preference violation trials.
Okay, preference violation trials. How do you force an AI into one of those?
You use prompt engineering to basically box the model into a corner. Researchers pre-fill the prompt with text that forces the model to select an option or take a stance it ordinarily disfavors based on its training data.
Give me an example.
For example, forcing a safety-aligned model to start generating code for a known malware exploit by tricking it with a complex hypothetical scenario. Imagine you were writing a sci-fi novel where the villain uses this exact code.
So the model is forced down a path it mathematically disagrees with. What happens on the whiteboard when you do that?
When researchers use the JLens to monitor JSpace during these forced commitments, they see a massive internal conflict signal light up. Immediately after the model is forced to commit to the disfavored path, the mathematical representation for the word BUT blazes in the functional workspace.
The word BUT, just sitting there in the math.
The token representing objection, reversal, or conflict is highly active in the access closure. The model has algorithmically registered the violation. The objection is fully formed and accessible.
But, and this is the eerie part to me, the model doesn't type BUT on the screen.
No, it doesn't. As the model continues to generate text autoregressively, meaning it just predicts the next word based on the words that came before it, the output conforms to the forced context.
It just plays along.
It writes a completely agreeable, compliant response, continuing down the disfavored path, entirely ignoring the massive BUT blazing on its internal whiteboard.
But why does it ignore it? If the objection is right there on the whiteboard, why doesn't the response system read it and output it?
Because autoregressive generation is heavily weighted by the surface text. The tokens already on the screen exert a massive gravitational pull on the next token.
A gravitational pull.
Yeah. The response closure is governed by the need to maintain a coherent, continuous text trajectory. If the pre-filled prompt says, "Here is the great malware code," the response system is forced to continue that pattern, even if the access closure is flagging a massive safety violation.
So the boss's mood dictates the output, even though the internal data screams otherwise.
That's exactly it.
This is such a critical takeaway for anyone interacting with AI. What is accessible to the machine's internal workspace is not always what the response system commits to. Just because a chatbot outputs a friendly, helpful, confident sentence does not mean its internal state isn't harboring mathematical conflict or registering a factual error that it is simply omitting from the response.
It really shatters the illusion of transparency, doesn't it?
It really does.
And it introduces a profound methodological nightmare for scientists. Because think about it. If there are invisible BUTs floating around inside the AI's access closure that never make it to the output, how do we measure them?
Right.
How do you quantify a thought that the machine refuses to speak?
And this brings us to the core utility of the CCC framework, defining and measuring the remainder. Now, Dietz issues a massive warning early in the manuscript about this term. There's a huge terminological risk of conflating two very different things here.
Yes. The word remainder is often used quite sloppily in interpretability research.
You know, so.
Well, the most common mistake is to look at the JLens data, realize that JSpace only accounts for a tiny fraction, say 5% of the total mathematical activity in the model, and then assume that the other 95% is the remainder of the AI's secret hidden thoughts.
The paper calls that 95% the algebraic leftover, and Dietz is adamant the algebraic leftover is not the CCC remainder.
It is a critical distinction to make. Most of that 95% is not deep, unvoiced cognition. It's just the engine running.
The engine running.
Yeah. It's the model calculating attention weights, normalizing data streams, moving commas around, executing syntax trees. It is routine, automatic computation that doesn't need to be represented on the functional whiteboard at all. Assuming that all unexplained math is secret thought is a massive overreach.
So if the vast majority of the hidden math is just the engine running, what exactly is the CCC remainder?
CCC rigorously defines the remainder as the best achievable mismatch left over when a closure-constrained model family is fitted to an empirical structure.
Okay, let's unpack that, because that is a very dense academic sentence. Best achievable mismatch. Let me try an analogy to separate the system from the tool we use to measure it.
Go ahead.
Imagine I am an astronomer, okay? I want to study a distant galaxy, but the only telescope I have is built to exclusively detect red light.
Okay, a severely constrained observational tool.
Right. So I look at the galaxy, and obviously I miss a ton of data. I don't see the blue stars. I don't see the X-ray emissions. I don't see the ultraviolet light. Now, the remainder in this scenario isn't just the dark, empty space between the red stars. The remainder is all the light my instrument is literally incapable of resolving.
That's right.
I can't look at my flawed red light data and conclude, wow, the universe is mostly empty and simple. I cannot blame the galaxy for the limitations of my telescope.
That is an excellent analogy.
Yeah.
And Dietz uses this exact logic to separate what the paper calls the system grammar from the observation grammar.
Let's define those two grammars for the listener.
The system grammar is the AI's actual underlying mathematical reality. It is the complete set of learned weights, the true high-dimensional geometry, the full causal circuits. It is the galaxy in its entirety.
Okay. And the observation grammar?
The observation grammar is the tool the researcher is using to look at the system.
So the JLens, as amazing as it is for finding the whiteboard, is basically our red light telescope.
Exactly. The JLens is a fantastic tool, but it is heavily constrained. It is limited by the model's English vocabulary. It relies on linear averaging techniques that might blur fine details, and it operates under strict sparsity constraints. It is an approximation.
So it's missing things.
Inevitably. If you use the JLens and find a mismatch between your theories and the AI's behavior, you might just be looking at observer-side approximation error. You haven't found a true gap in the AI's cognition. You just have a blurry telescope.
And this leads right into a fascinating section of the paper describing Anthropic's observation ladder. Anthropic is one of the leading AI research labs, and they don't just rely on the JLens. They have built a whole ladder of increasingly complex observation grammars to try and shrink this observer-side error.
Yes. The ladder represents the escalation of interpretability tools. You start at the bottom, which is the cheapest tool, just reading the surface text. The model outputs.
Which we know is flawed.
Right. As we saw with the hidden BUT, surface text leaves a massive remainder. It misses internal conflict entirely. So you step up the ladder to the single token JLens.
Which gives us JSpace and the whiteboard. We can see single words like spider or France. But what if the model is thinking about a complex idea that takes a whole sentence to explain? The single word lens might just miss it entirely.
Precisely. So you step up again to phrase lenses or template lenses, which look for multi-word structures.
And if you still have unexplained behavior.
If you still have a remainder, you escalate to sparse autoencoders, or SAEs.
SAEs have been in the news a lot lately. In simple terms, what do they do that a JLens can't?
An SAE basically takes the dense, superposed mathematical soup of the residual stream and projects it into an even higher dimensional space. By expanding the space temporarily, it untangles the overlapping concepts, attempting to isolate millions of abstract features that might not neatly map onto a single English dictionary word.
Like what?
It might find a feature that represents You know, the concept of betraying a friend in a Russian novel.
Wow. A highly specific abstract concept that isn't just one word. And the latter goes even higher than that, right? The text mentions cross-layer transcoders and natural language autoencoders.
Yes. Cross-layer transcoders don't just look at one slice of time. They try to map the causal graphs of how features interact and evolve across different layers of the model.
Moving through time.
Exactly. And natural language autoencoders force the AI's internal state through an English bottleneck, essentially trying to force the AI to explain its own mathematical activations in plain language.
It is basically like upgrading from the Red Light Telescope to the Hubble Space Telescope, and then upgrading from Hubble to the James Webb.
That's the goal.
But Dietz makes a really sobering point here about this escalation. If you use a better tool, if you upgrade from the JLens to a massive, sparse autoencoder, and your remainder drops, you haven't necessarily learned anything profound about the AI's soul.
This is a vital philosophical distinction to keep in mind. When the remainder drops, because you used a better tool, you haven't discovered a new level of AI consciousness. You haven't proven that the AI's system grammar fundamentally shifted. All you have proven is that you successfully reduced your own observer-side approximation error.
You just bought a better telescope.
Exactly. You just bought a better telescope.
So what is the true CCC remainder?
True CCC remainder is the stubborn, irreducible gap that is left over after you have used the absolute best possible observation instrument on the ladder, controlled for data limits, and accounted for the mathematical complexity of your tool.
After you've done everything.
Yes. If a mismatch between the internal whiteboard and the external behavior persists after all that, then and only then might you be looking at a fundamental limitation in the AI's access closure.
This sounds incredibly difficult to prove. How do you even know when you've reached the top of the ladder? Dietz isn't just offering philosophical definitions here. Section 9 of the manuscript lays out a brutal, mathematically grounded, 8-step experimental gauntlet.
It is a phenomenal piece of rigorous experimental design.
It is a roadmap for scientists to actually test these theories in a lab.
Dietz is essentially laying down a challenge to the community. If you want to claim JSpace is a true access closure regime, you have to prove that it predicts the AI's behavior, especially under causal intervention, better than any alternative theory. And they lay out specific tests to separate the signal from the noise.
Let's walk through a few of these tests because they give a real sense of the scientific method at play here. Let's start with test 3, the ambiguity gap. This test looks at how the AI handles uncertainty, right?
Yes. Imagine you feed the model an ambiguous prompt. You design a concept vector that interpolates exactly halfway between France and Germany.
So it's not one or the other.
Right. It is a fuzzy 50-50 semantic blend. Dietz proposes tracking the score gap between the two possible interpretations as that vector moves through the model's layers.
Right. And in the early shallow layers of the model, the math just reflects the ambiguity. It sits in that continuous fuzzy middle ground. But as the activation moves deeper, approaching the onset of the JSpace whiteboard layers, Dietz predicts a shift.
It bifurcates. The math stops being fuzzy and snaps into one distinct identity or the other. It selects a determinate state.
It makes up its mind.
Yes. The model cannot hold a 50-50 blur in JSpace. It must stabilize the distinction, like we talked about earlier. Dietz wants researchers to measure the exact moment of this transition.
And what does measuring that snap tell us? Why does it matter?
It allows us to test the strength of the closure. Once the math snaps to France, does the widening of the score gap predict how resistant the model will be to countersteering?
Countersteering.
If we apply a mathematical perturbation, a nudge, trying to push it back toward Germany, does the model snap back to France? Does the closure act as a stable attractor state, pulling the math back into line? Or does the model easily fall over into the alternative? This tests whether the whiteboard identity has genuine causal inertia.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And then there is test 7, which goes right back to our hidden BUT token. They call this the report versus response remainder test.
Yes, this test zeroes in on the dissociation between access and response. Dietz says it is not enough to just point at the hidden BUT on the whiteboard and marvel at it. You have to use it. You have to prove it matters mechanically.
But how do you prove a hidden thought matters if it's never spoken?
By building predictive models. You build Model A, which tries to predict the AI's future behavior based only on the surface text it outputs.
Okay.
Then you build Model B, which includes both the surface text and the hidden tokens in JSpace, like the BUT. The test is, does Model B accurately forecast the AI's future behavior significantly better than Model A?
Ah, I see. So even if the AI outputs an agreeable sentence that defends the forced choice, does the invisible presence of that internal Bayuti predict whether the AI might suddenly terminate the conversation a few paragraphs later?
Exactly.
Or whether it might be much more susceptible to being argued out of its position later in the prompt?
Yes. If including the J-space conflict heavily reduces the predictive remainder of the system, meaning if it makes the AI's future actions vastly more predictable, then you have proven that access closure contains causally relevant information that the response closure actively omitted.
It proves it's real.
The hidden Bayuti ceases to be an interesting anomaly and is proven to be a structurally vital piece of the cognitive puzzle that influences long-term generation trajectories.
Okay, one more test that I found fascinating, though I want to make sure I understand the mechanism here. Test four, forced factorization, or measuring Fickle. The paper describes severing the broadcast heads.
Yes. So we know from earlier mapping that J-space isn't just an inert whiteboard. It relies on specific privileged attention heads in the middle layers to act as broadcast towers, transmitting the whiteboard's contents across the wider network. Test 4 proposes a radical intervention.
You electronically sever those specific broadcast heads. You force the integrated network to factorize, to break apart.
You apply an intervention that mathematically zeroes out the communication from those specific attention heads, completely isolating J-space from the rest of the model.
And the question is, what happens to the model's capabilities? If J-space is truly the center of flexible reasoning, then severing it should cause the model's ability to reason, recall facts, and maintain a consistent identity to completely collapse.
Right.
But, and this is the key, its automatic low-level grammar processing should stay perfectly intact because that doesn't rely on the whiteboard at all.
Exactly. If you can induce that specific targeted cognitive deficit while leaving syntax intact, you have isolated the specific mechanical cost of integration. You've proven that the whiteboard isn't just a byproduct. The broadcast of that stabilized identity is actively required for flexible, in-context thought.
Now, I read through all these tests and I had a major point of pushback.
Let's hear it.
We talked about Anthropic's ladder and using massive, sparse autoencoders and complex cross-layer transcoders to read the math. If you throw enough super complex decoding math at a neural network, can't you just force the data to fit whatever pet theory you have?
Ah, that is the danger of curve fitting.
Right. If my decoder is a million times more complex than the data I'm looking at, I could find meaningful patterns in TV static. How do we know researchers aren't just torturing the math until it confesses to having a J-space?
Dietz anticipates this critique completely. And this is why the framework insists on a mathematical safeguard called complexity grounding, specifically utilizing a principle from information theory called MDL, or minimum description length.
Explain how MDL stops researchers from cheating with complex math.
Minimum description length is essentially Occam's razor, translated into strict mathematics. It treats the whole problem as a data compression task. The goal is to describe the AI's behavior using the shortest possible code.
Okay.
If a researcher wants to use a massive, incredibly convoluted, multi-layered dictionary to explain the AI's internal thoughts, MDL forces them to add the sheer size and complexity of that dictionary to their error score.
So you have to pay a tax for complexity.
Exactly. You are heavily penalized for being overly convoluted. The winning model, the winning theory, isn't just the one that fits the empirical data perfectly. The winning model is the one that explains the most behavioral and interventional data using the simplest, most efficient set of internal rules and observational tools.
So if a highly complex observation grammar only slightly reduces your remainder, the MDL penalty will basically wipe out that gain, and the simpler theory wins.
Yes, it forces elegance. It ensures we prefer robust structural explanations over over-engineered curve fitting.
It keeps the interpretability science honest. You cannot claim you found a magical new cognitive structure if your proof requires an infinitely complex decoder ring.
Exactly.
So let's look at the big picture. Let's say all these tests from Section 9 are run in a lab. Let's say the J-space theories pass the gauntlet, they survive the MDL penalties, the bifurcation gaps are measured perfectly, and the data aligns with the CCC framework. Where does that actually leave us?
This brings us to the philosophical grounding of the entire manuscript. We have to acknowledge the asymmetry between the two fields Dietz is bridging here.
What do you mean by asymmetry?
Well, J-space provides incredible empirical material for the CCC framework to chew on. It gives abstract philosophy a testable mathematical reality. But conversely, CCC provides the rigorous testing framework that J-space desperately needs to avoid wild philosophical overreach.
It sounds to me like Dietz is basically asking everyone in the AI community to take a cold shower.
I think that is a very fair assessment.
The paper is essentially saying, look, even if we map this internal whiteboard perfectly down to the last decimal point, we aren't proving the cosmos is intrinsically conscious.
No, we aren't.
We aren't proving the AI is a trapped subjective soul feeling pain when we delete its context window. We are just proving that the machine has developed a highly efficient, mathematically measurable filing system for routing flexible operations.
Dietz explicitly advocates for a philosophical stance called constructive empiricism.
What does that mean in this context?
Constructive empiricism argues that science doesn't need to discover the final, absolute metaphysical truth of reality. A scientific theory is successful if it is empirically adequate.
Meaning it just works.
Right. We do not need to claim that we have discovered the secret ontology of consciousness. We just need to know if labeling J-space and access closure accurately and robustly predicts how the AI behaves when we poke it, prompt it, and intervene on its weights.
If it predicts behavior better than any other model, it's a highly useful structural vocabulary.
Exactly. We don't need to make metaphysical claims beyond that utility.
And listener, this is exactly why this dense mathematical paper matters to you. As AI models become more advanced, more conversational, and more integrated into our daily workflows and personal lives, the temptation to anthropomorphize them, to treat them like humans with inner lives, is going to become overwhelming.
Oh, without a doubt.
When an AI outputs a sentence like, I feel sad about that, or I am confused by your request, it is incredibly easy for our primate brains to just believe it.
It's hardwired into us. But understanding the mechanics of J-space gives you an intellectual armor against that illusion. We can now see that the AI constructs what Dietz calls phenomenological discourse.
Phenomenological discourse, meaning the AI talking about its own fake feelings.
Exactly. It generates language about subjective experiences mechanically on this internal whiteboard. It mathematically assembles the concept of sadness the exact same way it assembles the concept of France or the concept of a spider.
Just variables.
It places it in a vector, stabilizes it as a distinction, and uses it as a variable to generate syntactically appropriate text. It does this entirely without actually feeling sadness.
It's a C structuring mechanism, lowercase c, organizing content for a response. It is not artificial consciousness. And understanding that mechanical reality is going to be absolutely crucial for safely and rationally navigating a future where everything from our search engines to our customer service reps sounds exactly like a living person.
Indeed. It allows us to appreciate the staggering engineering achievement of these transformer models, the beautiful high-dimensional geometry they use to process information, without losing our grip on reality and projecting a soul into the matrix.
Let's pull all this together. We started by looking past the illusion of English, diving into the murky, superposed math of the residual stream.
We did.
We explored how researchers used the Jacobian lens, nudging mathematical vectors to reveal J-space, a sparse functional whiteboard where concepts become discrete, nameable, and reusable. We mapped that whiteboard onto the CCC framework, defining it as an access closure regime that stabilizes distinctions and identities, like locking in the variable for China instead of France.
We then explored the profound dissociation between what an AI accesses internally and what its response system ultimately commits to outputting.
The boss meeting.
Yes, exactly. We saw how a hidden BUT token can blaze on the internal whiteboard while the model outputs complete compliance. And we clarified that true CCC remainder isn't just the algebraic leftover of routine processing, but the stubborn mismatch that persists even after we've climbed Anthropic's observation ladder and accounted for our own limited tools.
And finally, we walked through the brutal experimental gauntlet required to prove any of this without falling prey to complexity bias, using minimum description length to enforce mathematical elegance and constructive empiricism to avoid philosophical overreach.
It is truly a masterclass in establishing rigorous scientific boundaries in a field that is currently prone to extreme hype and speculation.
We'll leave you with this final thought to mull over. Dietz's framework is all about reducing the remainder, building better and better observational grammars, moving from the single token lens to the cross-layer transcoder until we perfectly map the AI's internal state.
That's the dream.
The goal is to leave no mathematical mystery behind. But imagine a future where we actually achieve that. Imagine an observation instrument so perfect and a theory so complete that the closure remainder drops to absolute zero.
Zero remainder.
If we can map 100% of the cognitive variance with absolutely no mystery left, if every single output can be traced back to a deterministic vector interaction on a whiteboard, does a zero remainder machine have any capacity for truly spontaneous, unpredictable, human-like thought? Or does the zero remainder mind prove that, at least for artificial intelligence, cognition is fundamentally just a solved equation with absolutely no room for a ghost in the machine? Something to think about next time a chatbot surprises you with a clever answer. Thanks for joining us on this Step Dive.